MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're here with Mike Tidwell, who corresponds to Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and Bill McKibben, who organized 350.org and has done a great deal more. And his new book is called, do you say the title Earth, or is it Earth?
Pretend you're Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Earth.
E-A-A-R-T-H. It's a whole new planet that we're living on.
I love that title. It's a great title. And they will both be speaking at an event on Thursday night in Washington, D.C., along with Jeff Biggers, artists. It's the CCAN's fourth annual Spring Fandango. And we're here with Mike Tidwell and Bill McKibben, and good to have you both with us.
Great to be here.
This is a very critical time, really, isn't it? I mean, for all this to be happening on the heels of what happened in the tragedy in West Virginia, that I'm sure Jeff Biggers will be talking about a great deal, and the battles here in Maryland to stop the transmission lines of MAP that go from the coal fields to the ocean, and then the announcement of President Obama's announcement that we're going to allow oil drilling off the in the ocean off of our coasts, which affects the state of Maryland and Virginia. So, Mike Tidwell, this is a prime moment for you to have organized this.
It is. I mean, we've got so much work left to do. I mean, we've come a long way in the Chesapeake region on clean energy in the last 10 years. In the early 2000s, when CCAN was formed, Chesapeake Climate Action Network was formed, inspired largely by Bill McKibben, by the way. There were no clean electricity standards. There was no Clean Cars Act in Maryland. We hadn't begun to clean up our power plants. And now we've achieved all those things in Maryland, and we have a governor that understands climate change. But we have a lot more to do. There's a lot more potential in the region, a lot of offshore wind potential in Virginia. The new governor in Virginia supports that. But at the same time, we still get over half of our electricity in Maryland, Virginia, D.C., from coal. Most people don't realize that, but it's the combustion of coal that's the number one cause of global warming regionally and globally.
And Bill McKibben, I'd like to give us a little preview of some of the things you may be talking about. I mean, your book, Earth, has really kind of set a tenor for a discussion, I think, about the reality of what we face.
Hey, and it's a reality that becomes clearer with every day. The new data released from NASA and the University of Alabama today make it clear that January, February, March were the warmest January, February, March in history, and that it's almost certain now that 2010 will be the warmest year on record. It's no longer a question of thinking about global warming in the kind of future tense, something that we're going to prevent from happening to our grandchildren to be able to live just like we did. We're in the rapids right now. The climate is changing. People are dying. Seas are rising. Ice is melting. All we can do now is, A, try to slow it down as much as we can, and that's what Mike, above all organizers in the whole country, has been doing such a good job of helping to lead this political battle. And, B, we have to figure out how to build communities strong enough to cope with that which we can no longer prevent. That's a tall order, and at the moment we're not winning, but boy, we're fighting. Mike's fighting. We're doing what we can at 350.org all over the planet. That part of it's exciting and good, but it's so far behind the curve.
And just to, I'm going to follow up a bit about 350.org, because, I mean, we are now – I have this right, Bill? We're now at 390. And explain
390. 350 parts per million CO2. It's the most important number in the world. It's what the scientists tell us is the most carbon we can safely have, and we're way past it already. We're 390 parts per million, going up 2 parts per million a year. That's why the Arctic is melting. It's why the oceans are turning acid, and it's why we have to work way harder on the politics of this than anybody, including the Obama administration, is willing to work so far.
And to get us down to 350 even could take decades.
Yes, we're not talking about stopping global warming. Mark, we're going to be lucky to, you know, if we do everything right, by the end of the century, we'll be approaching 350 again. The Earth will have sustained lots of damage in the meantime, but maybe its most basic systems will still be intact in the ways we're used to using them. That's the hope. It becomes a thinner hope with each passing year, and the need for action becomes greater and greater.
So Mike Tidwell, I mean, when what do you expect out of this event tonight? What are you trying to spur on here? I mean, your organization is focused in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia.
Yes, we are. And, you know, our goal has been for the last almost 10 years to raise awareness about the impacts and solutions associated with global warming in this region. And there are huge impacts on the Bay. A warmer Bay means less aquatic life. It means sea level rise, huge impacts on the America's largest estuary system. And we raise awareness about what's causing the problem in our region, which includes, again, as I mentioned earlier, the combustion of coal, much of that coming from mountaintop removal, you know, the most horrific mining process man has ever known. And Jeff Biggers will be with us at this event, this Artists for the Climate event, along with Bill and myself. Jeff Biggers has been fighting mountaintop removal and bringing coal literacy to our region as loudly as anyone. So Jeff will be speaking. He's an author. He's made films. He's just a tireless champion. So the goal is to, you know, bring the coal story to life in this Washington, D.C. event, to have Bill return. We always love it when Bill McKibben's in town. His new book, Earth, spelled with two A's, again, just a fantastic book. I finished reading it last night. Really, as always, you know, Bill writes like an angel. He makes the reality of climate change very vivid, very real, but somehow maintains a sense of hope in this fight that I personally have needed as someone involved in this campaign. So the three of us, and I'll be talking about Katrina and you know, the impacts of that tragedy, what we learned, what we did not learn, as detailed in my book, Bayou Farewell, that came out a few years ago. So the three of us plus some music, we're going to have a good time.
We, you know, it's important that if what did Emma Goldman say? If I can't dance, I don't want to be in your revolution. So, Bill McKibben, one of the things I remember hearing you a lot during the Copenhagen meetings, and I've been saying, and I'm curious what you think about this, and both of you think about this in terms of where the future goes with this movement around the world. The most uplifting, fascinating thing for me in Copenhagen was the fact that you had 100,000 people from every continent, led by indigenous people, by women, by poor people, by students, by activists, from every continent gathering together, this multiracial group of people. I've never seen something like that before in all my life of kind of fighting for social justice, to see that kind of gathering. That, in some ways, Bill, seems to me to be the kernel of where we have to start.
Absolutely. And if people want to see it, well, you know what? If it's possible, and I think it's going to be, when we're there on Thursday night, I'm going to show some pictures from through our work at 350.org. On an even larger scale, a few weeks before Copenhagen last fall, we managed to coordinate 5,200 rallies in 181 countries around the world, what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. Mike pulled off a couple of the really great ones down in your neck of the woods. But those pictures demonstrate just what you're talking about, Mark. It's very, very useful and good for Americans to see that this notion that environmentalism is something for rich white people couldn't be further from the truth. Most of the 25,000 pictures in our Flickr account are of poor and black and brown and Asian and young people, because that's what the world's mostly made up of. And they're all saying the same thing. We need some kind of future. We're not going to mortgage it for the short-term profits of a tiny percentage of the population. And that's what this fight's about.
And one of the fights you're making, like Tidwell now, on the Hill is around this cap and dividend bill, correct?
Yes. I mean, ultimately, to solve the climate crisis, we can't just rely on people to voluntarily go green. You know, unfortunately, in this nation, at least, awareness about climate change has grown a lot. You know, after Hurricane Katrina and then Hurricane Gore with this film, An Inconvenient Truth, there's a lot more understanding of the climate problem. But unfortunately, there's been way too much reliance on, you know, just a go green movement to somehow voluntarily solve this problem. And in, you know, in the past, and other great, you know, struggles for social revolution in this country, we haven't relied, for example, on, you know, bigoted Southern sheriffs to voluntarily go integrated in the South in the 1960s, or, you know, college campuses in the South to try integration on Saturdays and see how it feels. We, you know, sometimes we, the social injustice is so great, we just ban the practice. And that's what we need with the combustion of fossil fuels. We need to begin rapidly by statute phasing it out, not just relying on Aunt Betty to voluntarily change her light bulbs, but to make it so that the next time she goes to buy a light bulb, there are only energy efficient light bulbs. And we do that through a carbon cap, through a national carbon, a cap on carbon. If you want to pollute the atmosphere with greenhouse gases, you got to have a permit. The cost of those permits is going to go up over time. Now, what you do with that money from the auction is the real key. There are those who think we should actually give it to the corporations and let them, you know, use it for various programs that they claim will help get us off fossil fuels. We can give them permits for free. We can give them free passes, et cetera. But the better idea, one that Bill and I both support, is to cap carbon dioxide, you know, require an auction for anyone who wants to pollute our sky, and then simply rebate the vast majority of that money back to Americans so that even as the cost of their coal-fired electricity goes up, and it will, the coal burners will pass on the cost of the auction onto consumers, but as your electricity prices go up, you'll also get a monthly dividend check. You'll get a carbon refund that will protect you from rising energy costs, but for about 70% of Americans, you'll actually have more money in your pocket. You'll actually do well under this program. And the rising cost of fossil fuels, which is what we want. We want fossil fuels to get more expensive so it brings behavior change, it sends market signals. That rising cost will also spur people to be more efficient. So you'll get a monthly check. You'll naturally become more efficient, turning out the lights, buying energy-efficient products, and you'll actually have more money under a cap and dividend bill than some of these more complex cap and trade bills that have been before Congress.
And Bill McKibben, I coming back to some of the things you're writing in your new book, EAA Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. You liken, and I have not finished the book yet. I'm looking forward to finishing and having you back on the air to talk about the book. But you liken our condition to someone who has smoked a pack of cigarettes a day for 40 years and now needs to be on an oxygen mask. And he's alive, but life has changed. And you're saying that's where we are with our Earth.
We no longer have the option of going back to the world we were born onto. We've done too much damage for that to be possible, and we've got to face up to that and deal with it. And that's going to mean a lot of things, including that we're going to have to break the habit of endlessly relying on economic growth to solve every one of our problems. We're running into those limits of growth, finally, that people started warning about 40 and 50 years ago. That's a tough place to be, but it's tougher if you don't think about it, take it seriously, get to work on it. That's what we now have to do. So the book is a call to a certain kind of realism and a suggestion about what that realism might take us if we dropped some of the fantasies with which we've been living for a very long time.
Well, one of the things that you do again in the book, when you talk about Tom Friedman's ideas, who's he's a serious thinker, but what he's saying is that we need to build a growth economy, a new economy, but make it a green growth economy, and you're saying That is...
It's a little late for that.
Yeah.
If our idea is that we're just going to switch from... you're just going to keep everything the same in our world, but switch from coal to wind power to do it. I don't think we have the time or resources or ability to make that switch. I think we're going to have to change some of the things we demand out of this planet along the way. I don't think that's an entirely grim outlook. I think there are things that are very good about the world that we're moving into, and we can sense some of them already. The rise, say, of local food systems, much more resilient and much less demanding on the environment, are one of the best trends underway in this country. In the last 5 years, the number of farmers in the U.S. has actually increased for the first time in 150 years. That's a good sign.
Does that mean that are we talking about industrial farmers who plant corn that destroy
the
water?
No, we're talking about people who grow foods for their neighbors to eat. That's what we need now.
I drive past farmlands and I just think about that a great deal. There really is an internal struggle going on in the world of agriculture about how we can survive.
That's right. We don't need really much more corn syrup farming. We need food farming.
So I wonder what both of you, but Mike Tudor, starting with you, I mean, think about the balance between political action, on the part of organizations, personal action when it comes to how we live our lives, and what we have to do in a larger sense in terms of government to make those changes. I mean, there seems to be many forces at work in all of this. I mean, I know, Mike, you redid your home. You wrote that incredible piece about how you did it for $7,500, and it was inspiring to say that we don't have to be super wealthy to make our homes green, but that won't get us out of this. But that's part of it. So talk, the two of you, starting with Mike Tidwell, how the personal and the political and the larger questions feed into one another for you for the future.
Well, ultimately, it's all local. I mean, if we're talking about global warming, but if you lived in Baltimore, Maryland, the last few months, you saw an utterly unrecognizable winter weather pattern. I mean, it was, we lived in a world of trenches and canyons, trenches for the sidewalks and canyons for the streets because of all the snow. It's very local in terms of the impacts. I mean, this winter was just unbelievable. I think of the 10 biggest snowstorms ever to hit Baltimore since 1870, three of them came in 7 weeks between December, January, and February of this winter. So that's a very local impact. And if we're going to solve it, we're going to have to rely on a more local economy, as Bill spells out in his book. And that is, that's going to take a lot of rethinking and a lot of change of how Americans view the world. But it is already happening in many ways. All the great farmers markets throughout Maryland, the emphasis on local food, on organically grown food, is just one example. And you can get at a lot of these local changes through, locally inspired people making individual changes. But you can also get there legislatively. And if we simply put a price signal on carbon, if we make carbon fuels more expensive and alternative energy less expensive, you're going to see people travel less. People rely on food grown closer to home because it's going to be cheaper. You're going to see a lot of changes in communities. I mean, how did we get to a land of sprawl development? It was because of cheap oil. You make oil more expensive, and you're going to have more rationally planned communities. So it ultimately involves all of the above. We got to think globally. We got to realize what Bill's saying in his new book, Earth, that we live on a different planet, and we have to translate that into and we need to recognize the local impacts that we're seeing, like the snowstorms in Baltimore. But then we need to work on legislation that can transform this nation and move us toward more local economy.
Bill?
Well, everything Mike says is right. It's the best way to get local food systems, besides planting seeds in your backyard, is to get a price on carbon that starts finally to undermine the crazy economics of shipping our food thousands of miles at a time. What's interesting is that we think that much of the work that we need to do politically has that same kind of local-global dichotomy. At 350.org, following the lead of people like the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, we organize locally in thousands of communities around the world to have effect on the global and national political debate. We're really good at using the internet and other things to coordinate the kind of work that people are doing on the ground. We need people spending most of their time figuring out how to make their own places work, but we desperately need you to save 20% of your energy to do the campaigning that we do at places like 350.org for global and national solutions, because without them, there's no way to, you know, the best local food grower in the world still needs it to rain sometime. We have to solve this problem everywhere, or we're not going to be able to solve it anywhere.
Well, this has been really fascinating. I do appreciate you two taking the time out today, and we look forward to having much more lengthy discussions with both of you very soon. Bill McKibben, it's great to have you on the air with us. Mike Tidwell, as always, good to have you on the air with us.
Thank you very much, Mark. A real pleasure.
And we will look forward to getting everybody on our website to go down Thursday, April 15th. Income tax will be filed, 7:30 p.m. The Foundry United Methodist Church. You can go to chesapeakeclimate.org/climate. Artists for Climate, for more information. You can go to our website and also just log right on there, steinershow.org, and find and click right on, and you'll get more information and join our guest, Mike Tidwell, and Bill McKibben will be joined by Jeff Biggers for this wonderful evening event. And the woman singing, why I'm blocking on her name.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be Louise Green is going to be singing.
Right.
She's really great, wonderful music.
Thank you all so much, and La Luta Continua. We'll be talking soon.
Take care.
Thanks, Mark.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.